Well, thanks to the organizers for organizing such an amazing conference and such a great place and inviting me. Unfortunately, I'm not keeping my end of the bargain up. I'm not going to talk about anything to do with topological strings. I wanted to talk about algebraic geometry and just stability of algebraic varieties, which is pure abstract algebraic geometry and a piece of work with Julius Ross. But that would be sort of unfair, especially if there's physicists here. So what I'll do instead is I'll talk mainly about work of Donaldson and other people like Yao and Tian and so on, but really Donaldson's point of view on what this has to do with the existence of special metrics, so Kähler metrics with constant scalar curvature. This includes Kähler-Einstein metrics. So all the physicists have been writing down functionals and constrained functionals and everything. So there's one in this case, which is if you take a Kähler class on a complex manifold, in fact, it needn't be integral, but in my case, everything will be integral or at least rational. Then what you can do, so the Einstein-Hilbert action or whatever is the integral of the scalar curvature over the manifold. This is actually just given by, this is topological, so this is the first Chern class of X. But then we can see, and this is just a constant, so it's constant on the set of omegas equal omega 0 plus whatever, dd bar phi. But what you can do instead is write down the Kohlrabi functional, and you can take the minimizers of this are these constant scalar curvature Kähler metrics. So that's my only attempt to make this have anything to do with physics. I've no idea if it has anything to do with physics. Although Mike Douglas now writes papers about constant scalar curvature Kähler metrics, so maybe they do have something to do with physics. But a subset of these are Kähler-Einstein metrics. So Kähler-Einstein metrics. And this is in the case where omega is proportional to C1 of X. But I won't really mention any of that again. So what I'll do is I'll explain some geometric invariant theory. You won't know why until later on in the lecture. And symplectic reduction. So these are the two ways of taking quotients in Kähler geometry. And I'll discuss the link between them. And then I'll discuss some infinite dimensional cases. I'll discuss some finite dimensional cases and then some infinite dimensional cases due to Donaldson, which motivate what stability of algebraic varieties has to do with these constant scalar curvature Kähler metrics. And I'll explain the bundle analog, which is very well known, the Donaldson-Uhlenbeck-Yau theorem and the Hitchin-Kobayashi correspondence. And then I'll explain what's the stability of algebraic varieties version. And this is, and I'll just briefly mention the results with Julius Ross at the end on our criterion for stability, but I won't discuss any of the proofs or anything because it's all nasty algebraic geometry. Okay, so if you want to take a quotient in complex geometry, as I say, you'll see why I want to do this later, you have an immediate problem. So take some complex algebraic group, that'll be non-compact, so it's going to be reductive. Just imagine, for the purposes of this talk, it's the special linear group. In particular, it acts on a vector space which overlies a projective space. So I'm not taking the projective linear group, I'm taking the special linear group. So it actually lifts, it acts on projective space, but it lifts to an action on the vector space above. That's important, that's called a linearization of the group action. So I'll always assume that. And I want to form some kind of quotient of X mod G. And because this group is non-compact, the orbits are non-compact, the G action won't be proper. And so you won't be able to form a Hausdorff quotient just because these orbits are not closed, right? So there's a picture of three orbits whose closures all intersect in this smaller orbit. So in this picture, this very simple picture, it's clear what I should do. I should throw away the smaller orbit, and then I'll get a Hausdorff quotient. As it is, I clearly wouldn't get a Hausdorff quotient. Excuse me. But in general, that's not enough. You can't just take the top dimensional orbits. You still won't get a Hausdorff or separated moduli space or quotient space. So you're going to have to do more. And GIT gives you a sort of a way, there's many different ways of solving this problem, but GIT gives you a sort of systematic way of deciding which orbits to throw away in order to get a Hausdorff quotient. It also tells you certain semi-stable orbits sort of at the boundary which you should identify in order to compactify everything and get a projective quotient, but I won't really have time to talk so much about that. So how does GIT work? Well, it's completely tautological. It's very simple. As I'm sure everyone knows, in algebraic geometry, there's a correspondence between varieties with an ample line bundle over them and graded rings. So you replace a variety by essentially the functions on it, so the space of sections of this line bundle twisted and all its tensor powers. Okay? So O of R just means the sheaf of sections of L tensored up R times. So you just think of this as L to the R. And that gives you a ring, and then to go backwards, you just do this construction here, so it's something called PROG. This is a coordinate-dependent way of writing it, but it'll do. It can be done invariantly. So you take your graded ring, take a bunch of generators. Let's assume they're in degree 1 for simplicity. You can arrange this. So you have a bunch of generators, x0 up to xn, and they have a bunch of relations, and because of the grading, they'll be homogeneous. So these will be polynomials in these generators, f1 up to fk, and that corresponds to the following projective algebraic variety. You take the projective space on these generators, and you take the subvariety given by these relations. So this is a sort of more or less 1-1 correspondence. Okay, so everything comes down to graded rings, and so in order to form the quotient, we just need to form a graded ring. And if we do have a good quotient, so we can guess what the answer ought to be. Here's, suppose you had a good quotient, so this is x, these are the g orbits, and this is x mod g. Then functions down here lift up to give you functions up here, which are constant on the orbits. So they're g-invariant functions. So functions down here give you g-invariant functions up here. So all you do is you take the g-invariant sections of the line bundle, and that gives you a graded ring, and so it's also finitely generated by a theorem of Hilbert, and so it gives you a projective variety, and that's what the quotient is. So GIT is very simple, and the question is just, what are the points of this quotient? Which orbits have I thrown away, and which ones survive? So there's a few things to mention. One was, remember, I said G had been linearized. I'd lifted it to an action on the vector space, not just on projective space. That means, therefore, it actually acts on this line bundle. So this really, G really does act on this graded ring, so I can do this, because it acts on the line bundle. And, you know, these sections of the line bundle are really just polynomials on X. I mean, when I say functions, you can think of things as sections on line bundles and all their powers, or you can think of them really as functions on the cone on X. So you take X in projective space, form its cone in the vector space, everything that lies above it in the vector space, and we're really just talking about functions on that space. And it's a C star space, and this is its weight space decomposition. Okay, but it's just the standard thing. Spaces and functions on the space are in 1-1 correspondence, and you just take the g-invariant parts. So which points survive in the quotient? It's the semi-stable points. And a semi-stable point is one such that it's seen by these g-invariant functions. So you really stand a chance of seeing it in the quotient. So there is a g-invariant function which sees this point. And those are the semi-stable points. So it's purely algebraic definition. So in other words, if I try to map x into projective space using these functions, so this will clearly factor through the quotient, and its image is going to be the quotient, that x mod g defined on the previous slide. So a point x in here, little x in here, maps to a linear functional on these space of functions here. In other words, the linear functional is evaluation of these sections at little x. Okay, so little x gives you a linear functional on this vector space given by evaluation at little x. That'll define a point of projective space so long as that linear functional isn't identically zero. In other words, so long as there's some function which doesn't vanish. Okay? So this map is defined at x, and its image is a point in x mod g. Okay? So these are the semi-stable points. And then you're stable if moreover, this ring of functions here really separates you from other orbits, so it's not identifying you with any other point. So in other words, given any two orbits, there's a function which is zero on one and non-zero on the other. And it also does that infinitesimally. So if you have an orbit and a vector which is not tangent to the orbit, so it's normal to the orbit, there should be a function which vanishes on the orbit but whose derivative is non-zero in the direction of the tangent vector. In that case, x is called, well, polystable. And then in addition, if the orbit is of top dimension, then it's called stable. And then Mumford showed this wonderful theorem that these algebraic definitions agree with the topological definitions I was alluding to on the previous slide about closeness of orbits and so on. So x is stable if and only if the orbit is closed, not in projective space, because of course it'll be non-compact, but in this non-compact vector space. So you're stable if and only if your orbit's closed upstairs, and, sorry, that's polystable, and the orbit is of top dimension. And you're semi-stable if and only if your orbit's closure doesn't contain the origin. Okay? If the orbit closure contained the origin, then any g-invariant function would be constant on the orbit. By continuity, it would be take the same value as at the origin, so it would vanish. So there's a picture. Let me just go to the bottom of this slide. If you just look at the bottom here, this is a stable orbit here, where the orbit's closed upstairs. So here I've got x, and this is sort of the cone on x. This is the tautological line bundle over x. So this is the at least if I contracted the zero section, this would be the vector space upstairs. So I'm interested in whether or not the orbit is closed upstairs, or whether its closure contains the origin. So this is the stable guy. This is semi-stable because it doesn't go near the zero section, and this is the unstable guy. Okay, and the Hilbert-Mumford criterion simplifies this a bit more. It says you don't really need to consider the entire group orbit, you just need to consider one-parameter subgroups. It's just C-star orbits. So you take any one-parameter subgroup, and then you see whether that, if that's closed for all possible one-parameter subgroups, then you're stable. But there's a different way of telling whether a one-parameter subgroup is closed, and it's the following. It's this orbit here is asymptotic to this line, and all you care about is whether the C-star action on the line takes you off to infinity or down to zero. Okay, so the procedure is working out the weight of the action on this line. So you're stable if and only if the weight's negative. So your C-star action on this line is of the form sort of lambda goes to the lambda minus one or something. It takes you off to infinity. And you're unstable if it's positive and it's taking you into the origin. Okay, so the procedure is, in GIT, if you want to find out whether a point is stable or not, you start with your point, you choose any one-parameter subgroup, and you move your point through isomorphic objects. These are all isomorphic objects. They're all related by invertible group elements until you get some limit object. This is no longer isomorphic to X. This is in the closure of the orbit. It's not in the orbit. Associated to this limit object is a tautological line. So it's a line in a vector space. So this is a point of projective space, so you get a line in projective space, in a vector space. And what you want to know is what's the weight of the C-star action on that line. And if it's negative, then you're stable for this one-parameter subgroup. If it's negative for all one-parameter subgroups, then you're stable. So this is the generic situation, stability. And then every now and again, you'll get this non-generic instability. So let me give a simple example. So this is zero-dimensional algebraic varieties. I'm supposed to be talking about algebraic varieties, so this is the zero-dimensional case. So if I take n, this is the standard example. You take n points in P1, and what I want to do is consider those up to the action of SL2C. And these points, I'll allow them to come together and have multiplicities, so it's really a length n subscheme of P1. Well, n points in P1 are the same thing as a degree n polynomial on P1, or a homogeneous polynomial on P1, by taking its roots. So this is really the vector space that I want to take the quotient of. So up to scale, these are the same things as n points on P1. So the polynomial is only defined at scale. But so I always lift the group action to the vector space. This is the vector space. I want to take all degree n polynomials on P1 or C2, and divide those by the action of SL2C. And the theorem is that you're stable if and only if your points don't have any very fat point where half the points have come together. So long as each multiplicity is less than half of the total, then you're stable. So the only instability comes when half of your points are all at the same place. And this is the only proof I'll give in the lecture, because it's very simple. Well, this is two proofs of the same result. So the top half is one proof. So we just take any one parameter subgroup, then that looks like this with respect to appropriate coordinates. And you take any polynomial, remember this corresponds to n points in P1 by taking its roots, and you just see what happens to this polynomial under this C star action. And what happens is, this lambda to the minus k here will always take you to infinity, so long as you've got some y's somewhere. So the only way you won't go to infinity is if you've got more x's than y's in all of these terms. In other words, if all of the first n over 2 ai's vanish, then you'll have more x's than y's in this whole polynomial. So this polynomial will be divisible by x to the n over 2. Only in that case will there be no term which goes to infinity. But the generic case is that one of these coefficients at least will be non-zero, and then this monomial here will tend to infinity under this action here because of this lambda to the minus 1. Okay? So you're stable unless half of your AIs, the first n over 2 of your AIs, vanish. That's the only way that one of these monomials doesn't appear with negative weight. Okay, so that's the sort of the standard way of just seeing whether or not the orbit is closed. Alternatively, you can use the Hilbert-Mumford criterion. So what we do is we take our n points and we see where they go to. I've lost a picture. I'll draw the picture in a minute. You take your n points, you see where they go to, so that means you see where this polynomial goes under the C star action in the limit up to rescaling. And what it does is it... the first non-zero monomial here dominates. So this F tends to an F0, which is a monomial, where this is the first non-zero AJ. And then you calculate the weight on that, and the weight on that is of this form, and it's negative if and only if this J is less than N over 2. Okay? So you're unstable if and only if something like X to the N over 2 divides F. So if and only if at least N over 2 of the points lie at X equals 0. Okay? If and only if F has a root of order N over 2, X equals 0. Alright, so that's the only way you can be unstable, and then you use all possible C star actions, so all possible coordinate systems which moves this origin X equals 0 to any point of P1, and you get the result. Well, I seem to be missing a slide. Geometrically, what's going on is you've got your P1 and your C star action that has two fixed points. It has a repulsive fixed point and an attractive fixed point. So the U1 part of C star just spins you, but the radial part of C star moves you like this from the repulsive fixed point to the attractive fixed point. And generically, your end points are somewhere around here, and generically they all move down to here. And that's the stable case. They all end up with positive weight. This guy has positive weight. The only way they can end up with negative weight is if they all start up here. Because then they'll be stuck here, and so they'll end up with negative weight. So the generic situation is that they'll all end up down here, and so they'll be stable. Now, the other way of forming quotients is by symplectic reduction. So you replace SLN plus 1, SLN by SUN. So at least at the Lie algebra level, you're taking some real form of your group, and this is a LaTeX K, bizarrely. And so this is the Lie algebra of the real group, the unitary group, and this is its complexification is the Lie algebra of the full SL. Excuse me. This will sound good on the web. Right. This compact group, in SU preserves not just the complex structure like this group, but it also preserves a metric, and therefore it preserves a symplectic structure. So this group actually acts Hamiltonianly. So any direction in the Lie algebra gives rise to a vector field on your manifold, and it's actually a Hamiltonian vector field, so it's got a Hamiltonian. So there's some function on your variety whose symplectic gradient is this vector field. So putting all these Hamiltonians together, you get a moment map. So really it's just sort of R Hamiltonians, where R is the dimension of the group. But invariantly it's a map to the dual of the Lie algebra, if you work out what I've just said. Now, this Hamiltonian can be calculated in terms of that picture that I gave you before. So I'm just picking one, I'm just doing a one-parameter subgroup. I've just got one element of the Lie algebra, V. So I'm just considering a one-dimensional orbit at the moment. Okay, and I can calculate its Hamiltonian in the following way. What I do is I take my point X, I lift it to an X tilde upstairs. The answer got a log in it, so it'll be independent of the lift. So I'm upstairs in the line bundle or the vector space. And now I move according, like over here, not in the compact direction, but in the non-compact direction, the I times the compact direction. So I move in the radial direction in C star. And I look at how the norm, I should have said the symplectic form sort of equivalent to a norm on this vector space. So I look at the norm, the size of this lift, how far up the fibers I am, that's this distance, take its log, and differentiate that down this direction. And that's the Hamiltonian. So, in other words, when I'm at a critical point, so when I'm at closest to the zero set, the Hamiltonian vanishes. Okay? But if you remember before, we said you were stable if and only if all of these orbits went off to infinity in both directions. So in other words, you're stable if and only if by convexity you have some minimal... you achieve the minimum distance to the zero set. So you're stable if and only if this derivative vanishes somewhere on your orbit. Okay? So let me say that again. You're stable if and only if this Hamiltonian vanishes somewhere on your orbit. And that's stable for that one C star action. Now you want to be stable for all C star actions, so you want all these Hamiltonians to vanish, so you want the whole moment map to vanish. So it turns out you're stable if and only if the moment map vanishes somewhere on the orbit. Yes, that's really polystable because there may be high-dimensional stabilizers. Like this orbit might not have taken me anywhere at all, and then I would clearly achieve the minimum. And then stability is at the orbits of higher dimension. And so essentially what you prove is that this GIT quotient, where I take semi-stable points divided by the group, is the same as the zeros of the moment map divided by what's left of the group action that preserves this, and that's the compact group. So the picture's like this. Here are your big G orbits. The moment map provides a sort of a slice to the imaginary part of the G orbits, the radial directions. And then you have to divide out by the compact directions that are left to form the quotient. And then the unstable ones just go off to infinity. They never get here. They never reach this zeros of the moment map, which provide the slice to the radial parts of the group action. So the standard trivial example is you take U1 is the compact group, C star is the complex group acting on C to the N as scalars, just scaling, and so I want to get the quotient will be the space of lines in Cn, so it'll be projective space. So the unstable point's the origin, we remove it, and so we get C to the N minus the unstable point divided by C star is projective space. And then the symplectic quotient picture is that you've got a moment map, and the zeros of the moment map are a sphere, and when you divide the sphere by the compact group, then you get the other description of projective space. So the moment map, this sphere really is providing a slice to the transverse parts of the C star action. So we can go back to our standard example again, n points in P1, and we have SU2 acting on P1, and that has a moment map, and what that moment map is, it turns out, is just the two sphere sat inside R3. Okay, so identifying P1 with the round 2 sphere and SU2 with R3, then this is just the unit sphere, if I pick the symplectic form right. I'm sure I'm going to make it through this lecture. And then it turns out that when I take n points on P1, this is symmetric product of P1, then the moment map for the action on this guy is just the sum of those moment maps before. So I take n points in P1. P1 sat inside R3 of the unit sphere, so I've got n points in R3. I just add them up. 0 is the moment map of where these n points in R3 add up to 0, so they're center of mass 0. So the 0 is the moment map of balanced configurations of points. And so the Kempf-Ness theorem in this case says that you're stable if and only if, once you do some transformation of P1, you can balance these points. You can arrange that their center of mass is the origin. And we decided before that stability was the same as no point having at least half of the total mass sat there. And so that this theorem tells you that if you're in this situation, so no point contains half the total multiplicity, then there exists an SL2C transformation balancing these points. So one direction of this is obvious. If half of your points are sat at one point, you're clearly never going to be able to get the center of mass to be the origin, unless you're in this situation. But the force of the theorem is the converse. This is the only apparent contradiction to what I just wrote, but that this is polystable because it has a stabilizer. Okay, you can ignore this slide. So I've just talked about taking quotients. I'm trying to explain why I want to take quotients. It's because I want to form a moduli space of algebraic varieties. So this is sort of why GIT was invented, to form moduli of algebraic varieties. It turns out to be pretty hard. But anyway, so this slide is trying to show you why, if you try and form a moduli space of varieties plus an ample line bundle, you very quickly get to some kind of Hilbert scheme, but then... So what you do is you embed X in some projective space using this line bundle, and so you get a point of a Hilbert scheme. And that's very easy to describe algebraically. I mean, it sits inside a Grassmannian, as various people described. So, as I say, you don't have to follow this. But one way of seeing it is inside projective space, you can take all the degree K polynomials in projective space, and then you can take the subspace of those which vanish on X. So these are degree K polynomials in the ideal sheaf of X, so which vanish on X. And that subspace completely determines X. So I've got a point of a Grassmannian, a subspace of this vector space, and that determines X. And so it's very easy to see the Hilbert scheme with some boundedness results sits inside a Grassmannian, and you can describe that as an algebraic variety. But you've now got to divide out by the automorphisms of projective space. These points in the Hilbert scheme, which are related by an automorphism of projective space, clearly isomorphic varieties. So you have to divide out by the automorphisms of projective space, and so you get a geometric invariant theory problem. And so once you choose a line bundle on the Hilbert scheme and linearize, you now get, just for free from GIT, a notion of stability for this variety. And you get a moduli space parameterizing these semi-stable algebraic varieties. But what you'd like to do is work out the Hilbert-Mumford criterion and say what stability means for these varieties. The other thing you'd like to do is do the symplectic quotient. So what you need to know is the moment map, but it's just the same as the thing I said before. So we have our variety in projective space. Well, projective space itself as a moment map, right? SUN plus 1 acts on projective space, Hamiltonianly. So there's a moment map from projective space into this vector space here. So just as I had P1 sat inside R3, similarly there's a canonical map from Pn embedded in some high-dimensional vector space. And the moment map is just as before. So if I have some point of the Hilbert scheme, so some sub-scheme of projective space, then its moment map, its momentum, is given by summing this moment map over all of X. So what you do is you just integrate using the Fabini-Studi volume form on projective space. You integrate this moment map over X. You average it over X. So you just take the center of mass. That's what I'm trying to say. Yeah. Up to scale. You're taking the center of mass of this variety in this vector space. This variety sits inside this vector space, and you take its center of mass. I'm usually very manly and so on. It's just this week I'm struggling a bit. Right, so the zeros of the moment map are the balanced varieties. They're the ones whose center of mass inside this vector space are zero. Okay. And so what you expect is that stable algebraic varieties set inside projective, you can sit them inside projective space, do an automorphism of projective space, and ensure that their center of mass is zero. So Zhang and various people like Luo proved that indeed, if you're balanced, so you omit a balanced representative after an automorphism in projective space, then you're stable in an appropriate sense. They proved Hilbert-Mumford stability. Actually, I'm not sure if that's right. That maybe should say Chow stability. I'm not sure. There's all these different notions of stability depending on which linearization you chose, which line bundle on the Hilbert scheme. Okay, and then this moment map, you can there's an asymptotic expansion as all these parameters go to zero. So in other words, as I twist up my line bundle more, embedded in a bigger and bigger projective space, then this sort of this balance condition, this moment map, has some kind of asymptotic expansion due to many people. And it's sort of leading order first non-trivial term is the scalar curvature of the Fabini-Studi metric restricted to this variety. And so at least sort of formally and point-wise and assuming nice convergence, morally, what you should think is that balanced metrics, so those where this moment map vanishes, tend towards those where the scalar curvature, well, plus a constant, vanishes. So morally, you expect balanced metrics. So this is the only bit of magic in the talk that you just have to believe me, because I just have to believe it too, because I've no idea. So you have to believe that these balanced, if you take a variety and you can balance it in higher and higher and higher projective spaces, then that metric that you get from the Fabini-Studi metric should morally converge to a constant scalar curvature, Kähler metric. So, in particular, if your line bundle is the power of the canonical bundle, it should tend to a Kähler-Einstein metric. Obviously, there's convergence issues there and so on. So, the actual theorem that's been proved so far by Donaldson is that is sort of the converse. So, this is supposedly the easy way, but this is very hard. If X has a constant scalar curvature Kähler metric, then it can be balanced for in big enough projective spaces. And therefore, by these results of before, it's stable in an appropriate sense. Okay, so modulo a few small conditions to do with semi-stability in the automorphism group and so on, roughly speaking, it's proved that if you have one of these special constant scalar curvature Kähler metrics, then you're stable. And in the opposite direction, he proves the following. Suppose you're balanced, and then he has to assume, suppose that the Fabini-Studi metrics converge in appropriate sense, then the limit has constant scalar curvature. Okay, so that's the status of this conjecture. And, you know, no one expects to get much further. He can prove a lot more for toric varieties, but no one expects to get much further for a long time. So the problem is, scalar curvature, just knowing the scalar curvature is nice and close to being constant gives you no control on the metric. If you knew something about the Ricci curvature, then you could have some control on the metric. But you have no control on the metric, so the metric could be tearing the manifold apart and not converging while the scalar curvature remains zero or something. So no one really expects to get very far at the moment with this. So this was the finite dimensional GIT picture tending to infinity. Donaldson also gives a purely infinite dimensional picture. And very briefly, you don't really need to know what it is. It's the following. So you take your variety and you fix the symplectic form and now vary the complex structures. So what you do is you take Hamiltonian diffeomorphisms of this variety. By pullback, they therefore act on the space of complex structures on this variety or compatible complex structures. And there's a moment map for this action. So this infinite dimensional space has a symplectic structure. There's a moment map for this action, and it's just the scalar curvature. And so you expect stability for this infinite dimensional setup to correspond to these special metrics. Okay, so this is a big formal picture which ought to be true, that some notion of stability should be equivalent to the existence of these special metrics. And then there's some comments. So this is some of the history of it, so I don't get into trouble. And yes. that's about it. And what else have we got? Right, so what we have is the... in some sense, we have the infinite dimensional analog of the balance condition for points in P1. So for points in P1, we know everything. And the infinite dimensional analog is these special metrics. And we have part of the relationships of stability, but what we don't have is the converse, so that stability implies constant scalar curvature scalar metric. And part of what's stopping you getting that is you don't know what stability is, so we don't have the description of stability. So remember, in the points in P1 case, we had this algebra-geometric description of stability, which was that you didn't have these very, very fat points with more than half the multiplicity. But what you do have is the vector bundle case, which is more linear. This is like the, I don't know, Yang-Mills equations instead of the Einstein equations or something. This is all worked out, so let me briefly review that. So again, you could ignore the top of this slide, more or less. No, you can't. No, maybe it's the next one you can ignore. Right, so given now what I'm trying to do is, again, I've got an algebraic variety, and suppose I have a bundle over it. And what I want to do is form moduli of bundles now. So what I do is I show, given my bundle, I twist it up by the line bundle until it has many, many sections. So it's generated by its sections. So I can take the trivial bundle here, and by evaluation, I get a map onto my bundle. So my bundle is a quotient of this trivial bundle on X. And so I have a map. So every point on X, I have a quotient of this fixed vector space. So in other words, I have a point of a Grassmannian. Okay, so I get a map from X to the Grassmannian. And now you do everything as before. So the Grassmannian has an action of a group on it, and therefore it sits inside a... I'm not quite sure what's n here. N is the dimension of this space. So the special unitary group of this vector space acts on the Grassmannian, and it is a Hamiltonian action, and so there's a moment map from the Grassmannian into this vector space, the dual of the Lie algebra. Okay, so again, just believe that the Grassmannian sits naturally inside a vector space. So I've got this X inside the Grassmannian, so I can talk about whether or not X is balanced inside this dual of the Lie algebra. Right. And stable bundles admit balanced maps to the Grassmannian for high enough R. So this is the Kempf-Ness theorem in finite dimensions, essentially, and identifying some polarizations. And then pulling back the canonical... Well, on the Grassmannian is a canonical tautological bundle. When you pull it back, you're going to get your bundle E, twisted by R. And when you pull back the canonical quotient connection, so obviously on the trivial bundle on the Grassmannian, there's a canonical connection, so it descends to a connection on the quotient bundle. If you pull that back, that's not far from being a Hermitian-Yang-Mills connection on this, asymptotically as R goes to infinity. And so this is a conjecture of Donaldson, which was proved by Xiaowei Wang. What he proves is that in the limit, these connections tend to a Hermitian-Yang-Mills connection on this guy. So you end up with a new proof of the Donaldson and Lambert-Yau theorem that stable bundles have Hermitian-Yang-Mills connections. And this, again, is the sort of finite to infinite dimensional GIT picture. There's a purely infinite dimensional GIT picture, which is much older due to Attia and Bott. So the infinite dimensional picture is you pick all connections on your bundle, which are integrable, so they define a holomorphic structure, and you act by gauge transformations, and there's a moment map, and it's the Hermitian-Yang-Mills form. So the zeros of this are the Hermitian-Yang-Mills connections. And so Hermitian-Yang-Mills should be related to stability of bundles. But in this case, we know what you can carry out the GIT, the Hilbert-Mumford criterion, and you can actually find what stability of bundles means. So I think most people are familiar with what stability of bundles means. But, I mean, that's not just a definition. It's a lot of work due to Giesecke, Maruyama, and Simpson in working out this Hilbert-Mumford criterion and working out what it gives you. So let me tell you the answer. So you need some topological Riemann-Roch data, and it's the following. You take your bundle, twist it up, take the number of sections, this is the dimension of the space of sections, and you get a polynomial, and the first coefficient is the volume of the manifold times the rank of the bundle, second coefficient is the average scalar curvature of the manifold plus, no, nonsense, I'm in the wrong picture. It's the degree of the bundle plus some terms which depend on x, which we'll see later with varieties. And so that's the Hilbert polynomial. Now I can take the monic version, which is called the reduced Hilbert polynomial, where I just divide by the first coefficient. And then it turns out, when you work out the Hilbert-Mumford criterion, that you're stable if and only if for all sub-bundles, and in fact sub-sheaves of your sheaf or bundle, you have that the reduced Hilbert polynomial is less than the reduced Hilbert of your subsheaf is less than the reduced Hilbert polynomial of your sheaf. And that, if you ask that instead of these polynomials having an inequality on them for large r, if you ask that that inequality happens at the level of the first coefficient, a1 over a0, then you get the notion of slope stability, which I guess people are more familiar with. So that's the slope of the bundle. So slope, it's only called slope because it's a quotient of two things. It's a1 over a0 is less than the slope of the sheaf. Okay, and this corresponds to a different line bundle on the quad scheme. So when you form moduli bundles, I did say ignore a slide. It turns out it wasn't in there, so that was fortunate. So when you try and form moduli of bundles, you end up with, instead of the Hilbert scheme, you end up with something called a quad scheme, and you have to divide that by a group. But as usual in GIT, you have to choose a linearization, you have to choose a line bundle on it. Depending on which line bundle you choose, you get different notions of stability. This is the sort of the Giesecke or Simpson line bundle, and this is Jun Lee's line bundle, following the work of Donaldson here. Okay, so you have these two notions of stability, but the reason I put all this in is it will be very reminiscent of the algebraic varieties case that I'm just about to show you. Okay, so you take this Hilbert polynomial, you make it monic, and then you ask for an inequality on these monic Hilbert polynomials of your vector bundle and subsheaves. Okay, so bundles can be destabilized by subsheaves, and that's really all that happens. So you might ask whether schemes or varieties can be destabilized by subvarieties. For instance, a very good example is if you take the projectivization of a vector bundle and the projectivization of a subbundle, if you get a subscheme, can that destabilize this variety? So, for instance, our endpoints in P1 that we keep harking back to, in some sense, they were destabilized by any length n over 2 or more subscheme, connected subscheme. So any extremely fat point destabilized the endpoints in P1. So we want some kind of generalization of that. Good Lord. I'm not sure if you want to see this slide. Okay, this is purely technical and is not necessary. So it's sort of necessary to make the talk complete, as you'll see on the next slide, but you can ignore this. I'm just trying to define all the different notions of stability that are relevant here. I would advise ignoring this slide. Okay. So, but for completeness and for any pedants in the audience, I've got it here. So, I want to evaluate the Hilbert-Mumford criterion. So I take my variety in projective space, and I want to move it by a one-parameter subgroup, and then I want to calculate some weight. I want to see if the orbit's closed or not. So this is what I get. So I take my variety in projective space, and I move it by this one-parameter subgroup, then I get a whole family of varieties, a flat family of varieties, which are all isomorphic. There's a C-star action on this whole thing, making everything isomorphic except for the central fiber, which will be some non-isomorphic variety. Okay? And then this is called a test configuration. So this just means a C-star equivariant family over C. So there's a C-star action up here covering the usual one on C, which pushes you into the origin. That's the origin there. You see it in red. And there's a C-star action on the line bundles covering all the other C-star actions and so on. And the Hilbert-Mumford criterion says you pass to this limit point, there's a line associated to that, and you work out the weight on it. This is the line, so it's just something constructed out of the space of sections of the line bundle over your central fiber. So here's your central fiber. Here's the line bundle over it. Take the spacer sections, do some stuff to it, and you get a line. And now C star acts on everything here, so you get a weight, a C star weight on this line, and you want to know what it is. Okay? So this is the line relevant to Hilbert-Mumford stability. And then, but it turns out that all the other lines and all the other weights can be written in terms of this one. So that's why this slide is here. So you get a line, you get a weight. It turns out that's a polynomial in these two parameters, R and K. And the coefficients themselves are polynomials, and so on and so forth. So I wouldn't pay too much attention to that. But it's just as with bundles, there were different notions of stability. Similarly here, there's different notions of stability. So you're unstable if and only if this weight is positive, right? If your orbit's not closed. But there's positive in different senses. And so, in particular, if the weight really is positive, then you're Hilbert-Mumford unstable. So that's the weight on that line on the previous slide. If you choose other lines, you get different notions of stability, but they can all be written down in terms of this weight. And what it is that you can ask, instead of the weight being positive, you can ask whether it's asymptotically positive as R goes to infinity. You can ask whether it's that positivity happens at the level of the first coefficient. So as R goes to infinity, you can take the leading coefficient. No, sorry, as K goes to infinity, you can take the leading coefficient and ask whether that's positive. You can ask whether that's positive as R goes to infinity. Or you can ask whether its leading coefficient is positive. Because there's a polynomial in two variables, and the easiest case is where the leading coefficient of the whole thing is positive. This is called the Futaki invariant. Okay, so there's all these different notions of stability, and the point is this is sort of the simplest one. This is most like slope stability, and this is exactly the one which relates to special metrics. And then these are other notions of stability. This one's not so bad, and then these are hideous. Okay, so you've recovered from that. So you can forget everything I've said except the except what stability for bundles was. So this is supposed to be analogous to stability for bundles. Okay, so with bundles, I had a Hilbert polynomial, which is the space of sections of the bundle twisted up. Well, this is the Hilbert polynomial for a variety. I just take space as I just use structure sheaf. So I take space of sections of the line bundle. That gives me a Hilbert polynomial. Now with bundles, I destabilize by subsheaves. For varieties, you destabilize by subschemes. So here's your subscheme or submanifold of X. And what you do is you take something called a Hilbert-Samuel polynomial. So you take, what this says is the space of sections of, this is the degree R polynomials, space of sections of L to the R, which vanish on Z to order X times R. So X is some rational number. And R times X is an integer. You take that guy, but you can't take X, so you're sort of using Z and all of its thickenings, X times Z. You can't let X get too big, otherwise there'll be no sections. So you have to take X, you have to keep X below some constant called the Chaudhry constant. So that's just the supremum of numbers of X is such that this guy has lots of sections. So that's just some number, depending on this subscheme. Okay? And once, so long as X remains less than that number, this is also a polynomial in R. But its coefficients are functions of X, and they're polynomials in X. So that can be, they can be extended to all real X. All right? And then the relationship between these polynomials in X and these numbers is that when I put X equal to 0, obviously Z becomes empty. There's no condition here. And I get back to this. So when X is 0, I get back to these numbers here. Excuse me. Yeah, there's the K energy as well. I'm not... You'd have to ask Tian or Mabuchi. Yeah. So it's due to Tian originally, but this sort of modification, this is Donaldson's modification, not this, the previous page. Yeah, I don't know. Okay, so we have these numbers, and now what we do is we just take the slope. If you remember before with bundles, we just took A1 over A0. Okay, so that's what we take as the slope of X. So this is like the slope of the bundle. Okay, so it's just A1 over A0. So I sort of make everything monic and then take the leading coefficient. For z, I've got all these different... x can vary, right? So I have to take some kind of average over x. And so this is the slope of z. I average sort of a1 over a0, where x runs from 0 to c, where c is any number less than this epsilon. I could then take the supremum over c, but don't worry about that. I'll just carry this parameter c around. Okay, so I have a slope of x and a slope of z. So these, again, are just topological numbers, just as before... slope of a bundle is some topological Riemann-Roch thing. These are just topological numbers. The only where the holomorphic structure really enters is in this epsilon here. And those are the topological numbers for the slope of x. So this is like the scalar, average scalar curvature. This is like the volume. Okay, so we get slope of x, slope of a subscheme. There's a prime. Oh, that's a derivative of a0. Yeah, sorry, that's a sort of a correction term that I could explain later if you wanted. That's the derivative of a0. It is under the integral sign. Yeah, you could integrate it. I'm aware of the fundamental theorem of calculus. But it looks sort of... it looks nicer like this. It's two terms otherwise. Okay. Okay, and then our first result is that K stability implies slope stability. So K, well, let's do semi-stability first. K semi-stability implies that the slope of any subscheme is less than the slope of X. And this will be true for any C in that range. And then K stability is slightly more technical because it's that the slope is less than the slope of X, but then you've got this issue about whether you let C reach this value epsilon, and you only do that if when you let C go to epsilon, this guy really has lots of sections. Okay, so there's a slight technicality there. But roughly speaking, semi-stability says that the slope of Z is less than the slope of X, less equal, and stability says that it's really less than. And so the first result you get from that is that if you're destabilized by some subvariety, then you can't have a constant scalar curvature Kähler metric because of these results of Donaldson and people. That when you have constant scalar curvature, then you're K semi-stable. So there are all these different notions of stability, and I'm not really going over too much about the difference between them. Okay, so if you're unstable, then you don't have one of these metrics, right? So the simplest example, although the hardest to calculate, is the example I was alluding to before. So suppose you take a vector bundle with a destabilizing subbundle, and you projectivize everything, then you find that this subscheme here destabilizes this variety, at least when you choose the polarization right, so that the fibers are very small and the bases are very big. But if you're on a curve, you get much better results. The polarization doesn't matter. For any polarization, so for any Kähler form, you find that if you've got an unstable bundle, then it doesn't have a constant scalar curvature Kähler metric on its projectivization. So there's lots of people, for instance, work out which projected bundles admit constant scalar curvature Kähler metrics, and this is pretty much the converse to all their results. So this pretty much settles which projected bundles have constant scalar curvature Kähler metrics, and it's precisely the projectivization of Hermitian-Yang-Mills bundles. So that's sort of pretty. Some other examples. Minus one curves on Delpezzo surfaces often destabilize if you choose the polarization right. In particular, you can find examples of varieties, Delpezzo surfaces with reductive or even zero automorphism group, which don't have constant scalar curvature. So this is in contrast to Kolarbi's conjecture that these metrics should be governed by the automorphism group. If, however, you choose the anticanonical polarization, then Tian shows that they are Kähler-Einstein, so they do admit constant scalar curvature Kähler metrics. So these polarizations are not the anticanonical ones. If you blow up P2 in one point, then this doesn't admit a constant scalar curvature Kähler metric, but that's because of reasons of the automorphism group. It's that the automorphism group isn't reductive. So you know that it can't admit one of these special metrics, whatever polarization you choose. And you can prove that by our methods by showing that the minus one curve always destabilizes. You can also have that minus two curves destabilize, blah, blah, blah. And then you can show that Calabi-Yau manifolds are in fact Calabi-Yau varieties with canonical singularities, and varieties which are they're slope stable, so they satisfy our stability criterion. You actually know that anyway using Yau's theorem, that they admit these Ricci flat metrics, but that would be a very long proof that would have to go through all of Donaldson's analysis. Sorry? Right, with numerically trivial canonical bundle. Yeah. That M is just because the canonical bundle might not exist. Q Gorenstein or something. And canonically polarized varieties, again with canonical singularities, so these are the canonical models, are also slope stable. And then curves are slope stable, except P1 is slope polystable. I didn't really define that for you. And then we have lots of... So I've only got 5 minutes left, so I won't talk about the converse, but we prove lots of results on the way to trying to prove the converse. So we have a program which doesn't work, which should show that slope stability implies stability. So the two things are equivalent. But there's a very serious flaw in that program, which is certain subschemes of certain test configurations, which are nice and flat over C, their thickenings, when you just square the ideal or something, the thickenings aren't flat over C. So this kind of behavior can happen, and this stops us proving that at the moment that slope stability implies stability. But we can get around all these problems in lots of different cases, and one of them is curves. So in curves, you get a complete converse that slope stability is equivalent to k-stability. So you get a proof that smooth curves are k-stable, which isn't very interesting because they can be uniformized. And so you know they have constant scalar curvature Kähler metrics anyway. And then finally, I'll just say, we have a notion of slope for every other type of stability as well. So I'll just briefly tell you what the one is for Chow stability. So this is some kind of discrete analog of the integrals I had before. The previous version was some integral version. This is just a sum. So it's exactly the same thing. Again, I have a Hilbert polynomial and some coefficients. And then I have this Hilbert-Samuel polynomial and some coefficients which are polynomials in X. And now what I do is I take my C again, but C has to be an integer now. Everything's discrete. I didn't say that here, but C is an integer. And then I get a notion of slope for Chow stability. So this Chow slope, and this is some kind of discrete version as before. So the denominator is the same as before, and the numerator is slightly different. And when you take the empty set, you get the Chow slope of X, which is this guy. Okay, so if you're in Pn, then it's just n plus 1 over a0. And again, you show that if your Chow stable, then your slope stable. So the Chow slope satisfies an inequality. And again, this guy, for curves, we can prove, smooth curves, we can prove that Chow stability and Chow semi-stability are equivalent to slope stability or slope semi-stability. But in general, we can only prove one direction. Then I have lots more slides describing the algebraic geometry, but you don't want to hear that, so I'll stop there.